Welcome to the Nation of Writers podcast, presented in conjunction with our exhibit, American Voices, which you can explore in person or online at nationofwriters.org. In this episode, we'll discuss the life and work of fiction writer Kate Chopin, who dared to write about female sexuality, longing, and identity at a time when women were expected to focus on husbands and family. Chopin's works mostly take place in Louisiana and lyrically reflect the many cultures of the region, Creoles, Acadians, African Americans, and others. Her first novel, At Fault, in 1890, went largely unnoticed, but her second novel, The Awakening, in 1899, caused a stir. In this nuanced story, a woman strives to reconcile outward conformity and inward passion, and seeks to realize her potential beyond marriage. She also wrote about 100 short stories in the 1890s that were well received in popular magazines. Chopin's work was mostly forgotten after her death in 1904, but scholars have since rediscovered it and praised it for its truthful depictions of women's lives. Thank you to the Kate Chopin International Society, whose website includes a number of resources to learn more about her. For this episode, we are joined by two co-founders of this organization. Bernie Kolosky is the author of Kate Chopin, A Study of the Short Fiction, and the editor of multiple Chopin anthologies. And Heather Ostman is president of the Kate Chopin International Society and the author or editor of 10 books, including most recently Kate Chopin and the City, The New Orleans Stories. You can read their full bios in the episode description. Bernie and Heather are interviewed by Nate King, digital content associate at the American Writers Museum. This conversation originally took place March 8th, 2024, and was recorded over Zoom.
Well, thank you, Heather and Bernie, for joining me today on this episode of Nation of Writers. I'm excited to talk about Kate Chopin with you. Before we get into that, though, I'd like to learn a little bit about yourselves. Heather, would you like to start us off on that?
Sure. Thank you so much for inviting us. It's a pleasure to be with you today. My name is Heather Ostman. I teach English at SUNY Westchester Community College right outside New York City, and I'm the president of the Kate Chopin International Society. I've served for 20 years. This is our 20th anniversary with my colleague, Bernie Kolosky.
And Nate, thank you again. Thanks. It's good to be here with you. I'm not very far away from you, you know. I'm just down the road here in Champaign, Illinois. Like Heather, I'm a lot older than Heather, so I'm retired now, and it's why I'm living here in Illinois. But I've spent my whole life in Pennsylvania, although I've been outside of the country a lot. I've taught in Poland for 3 years, and I taught in India, and I taught in Russia, actually. And my wife is French, so we're in France every year for the past maybe 40 years. And like Heather, I've been writing about Kate Chopin for all these years, done some books and some articles. And for like 20 years, as Heather said, we've had this website, and I've been co-editing that with Heather. So yeah, we both are working with Kate Chopin. I've been at it a little longer.
You and I have done a couple books together too. Actually.
That's right.
We're working on one together.
You're
taking an essay. It aligns with some of Bernie's international perspectives. This particular collection of essays, I'm serving as editor for, but the essays are drawn from scholars all around the world, and measuring Chopin's impact in countries on about 4 different continents, I think it is. So we're working on that together. I don't know where we are at this point. It's our second, third, fourth book, but the work keeps coming. She's been good to us, Chopin.
Yeah. I love that. Can you tell me a little bit about how you first came across Chopin's work? Our listeners, just so you know, the Kate Chopin International Society. There's links to that in the episode description. It's a great resource if you want to learn and read Chopin's work. It's all there. But Heather, could you please tell us a little bit about how you first encountered her work and how that stirred a lifelong passion and of scholarship about her?
Sure. So I didn't realize it until I started to count out the decades, not just the years, but the decades of how much my scholarly work and even just my reading of Chopin has been a central piece of the last 30 years for me. So since I was in college, I first read The Awakening by Kate Chopin. That's her major novel, her best known novel, 1899, in a women's literature course. And it like blew me away. Just blew me away. I was 18 years old and I couldn't believe that I saw myself in those pages. And so since then I've kept coming back to it over the years, and I think Bernie understands this. It always looks different, to me. And I don't, it's one of those books, like you read it and you're like, wow, where'd that come from? Is this a new edition? You can't believe, like, where is this phrase from? From something that I think I know so well, I always am surprised by. And so subsequent to that, I've just read her short stories and other things. And it's been a part of my life that I didn't notice until about a couple of years ago. In this time, the last 20 years, we founded the Kate Chopin International Society. We've had tons of panels, and mostly at the American Literature Association. I'm working on my sixth book about her work, her fiction. It's a always, critical work. And it just dawned on me that this has been such a essential part of my scholarly, imaginative research life. And I didn't realize it. Isn't that funny? I just didn't even realize like how much my life had sort of circled around a lot of the issues and things that come up when I read her work. And I think it's always different for me. So it was very subtle. I didn't notice it until, and I know I'm dating myself, but it's so amazing, right? 30 years of commitment to study and appreciation of a particular author is remarkable.
Yeah, and it a testament to that writer's longevity, right? And how she can impact you in different moments of your life.
Yeah, I mean, like, I'll just add one thing before Bernie answers the same question. And Bernie's got a really interesting perspective because he has a book, right, Awakenings, on how lots of people engaged her in the first, early years of their, scholarly life. But my students always have reactions to her work. It's a pleasure to teach Chopin. Nobody's neutral to her work. And what's so interesting is that generationally, it changes. There's been times where students have had this very conservative reaction, and sometimes they see things that I don't see. And I say conservative because I don't see it. They're a little more condemning of some of her characters, like that transgress convention. So it's so interesting. It's always been interesting.
Yeah, almost like the reaction to the awakening is a sign of the times that we're in, almost, or yeah.
It totally is. Emily Toth, in an interview at a PBS video, says that she talks about a time, I guess it's in the late 60s, one of her friends hands her a copy of the book, and they're like, can you believe this? And it speaks to this moment of the 60s even. It's remarkable.
Yeah. Bernie, how about yourself? Can you tell us a little about how you encountered Chopin's work?
Boy, if Heather is dating herself for what did you say, 30 years?
And me both.
Nate, I've been at this for half a century. I know that sounds ridiculous to say, but it is. I came upon her because I wrote one of the very first PhD dissertations about her. If you want to be an English professor, you have to do a PhD, and to do that, you have to write a dissertation, and you have to pick a subject. So, Kate Chopin had. Pretty a little background here. Kate Chopin had died in 1904, and pretty much her work disappeared from view for a couple generations, really. It came back a little bit in 1932 when a guy wrote a book about her, but he was a Roman Catholic priest, and he really couldn't deal with the awakening. He couldn't deal with what Kate Chopin was doing. And so her reputation then disappeared again until after World War II. And at that point, people began to see her. And by the time I was ready to do my PhD dissertation, a complete works of hers had been appeared. It had appeared, and so did a new biography. And so I went to my advisor, the person who was supposed to guide me through this project, and I said, I'd like to write about Kate Chopin. And he said, No, this is a bad idea. The way he said it is, nobody really knows her. He didn't know her, actually. Nobody on the faculty knew her. And he said, you're never going to find anybody to publish your stuff if you write about an unknown writer. He said, if she were any good, we would know about her. And so we went back and forth with this for weeks. I would go into his office and say, I'm still liking to write about her. And he would say, no, you should write about F. Scott Fitzgerald, he thought, which would not have been a bad choice. I mean, he knows how to write too. So finally, on some one Friday afternoon, my time was running out. I didn't have a whole lot of time to work on this thing. I needed to go back to my teaching position. I went into him on a Friday afternoon, and I gave him a little paperback copy of The Awakening. There was just one available at that point, a little orange paperback. And I said, could we have this agreement? If you take this home over the weekend and come in here Monday and tell me this is not worth doing, I promise you in the afternoon, Monday afternoon, I'll start on F. Scott Fitzgerald. So he agreed. So he agreed to do this. And he came in. I went to see him Monday morning. He was one of these impeccably neat guy who was head of the department. He had this big walnut desk with nothing on it except that little paperback copy of The Awakening. And I looked at him and he looked at me. And he held my gaze as if he was struggling with his emotions. And I'll always remember this. He just slid the book across the desk to me and said, "Do it. You're right. I don't know how we missed her. It's a beautiful book. Do your dissertation, but get to work." So that's how I came upon her. And then I've been at it for, as I say, ever since. Actually, a lot of us, there were, I think, five or six of us who all published our dissertation in that same year because suddenly everything, her complete works was suddenly available. Before that, you had to dig around with libraries to find various things, but now it was there. So I think Heather and I both go back a ways.
Yeah, thank you for that. That's great. Perhaps we should give our listeners a little bit of a background on Chopin, kind of like a short little bio. There's a full bio that you can read on the K. Chopin International Society website. But just for our listeners, a little bit of kind of the time period she was living in and then writing in, because I think that is very important to understanding her work as well, as knowing the time in which she was living and then writing. Bernie, would you like to could you give us a little bit of background on her?
Sure. Well, we're talking about the 1890s. K. Chopin wrote virtually everything between around 1888, is that right, Heather?
88,
And
yeah.
in 1904, she died in 1904. So she had a very short career, really only about 15 years, maybe. She was born in 1850 in St. Louis, which was at that time a slaveholding state. Although during the Civil War, which you remember started in eight, it was ran in the 1860s, it did not leave the Union. It was one of these odd states that was a southern state but was occupied by northern troops during the Civil War. So she grew up in St. Louis, and her family is, this is kind of important, I suppose. Kate Chopin was bilingual from birth. She always spoke both English and French, because her family had French roots. Her mother had French roots. And as she grew up, she went to a Roman Catholic school, so she studied with Catholic nuns. She was married in 1870, took a quick trip to Europe with her husband. That was the only time she was outside the country. Because he was from Louisiana, she moved from St. Louis to Louisiana, first to New Orleans, where she lived with him for how long, Heather? 14 years, I believe. Is that about right?
Yeah, I
Yeah.
think so.
Wait, I have
I
the
can double
chronology.
check. I
Yeah,
have it right here.
we need to check on the chronology. She lived first in New Orleans. Her husband was a broker, a cotton broker. He was a businessman. And then eventually the business that he was doing didn't work too well. So he had family and property in Natchitoches, which is in northern Louisiana. They lived there for a few years. And then her husband died when she was very young,
She was 32.
32. And
Yeah, it was 1882.
in the meantime, she had six children, five sons and a daughter. And when her husband died, she moved back to be with her family in St. Louis. At that point, I suppose you could say her awakening to literature began. She hung out with a group of rather brainy types in St. Louis, newspaper men and a philosopher or two and a doctor or two, and they encouraged her to write. So she started that in around 1888, am I right, Heather? Somewhere around 88, and kept writing. She started, actually, the first thing she published was a piece of music. She was a very musical gal. She published a polka. And then she started publishing some short stories. She published a novel, which Heather did a book about a couple of years ago, a collection of essays by various scholars about this first novel of hers, At Fault. That didn't make much of an impact. So she published it privately, and it didn't sell well, and nobody very much paid attention to her. But she started writing short stories, and those short stories clicked because they were stories. Almost everything she wrote is based not in St. Louis, although a few things are in St. Louis. They're based in Louisiana, and they're stories about the people of Louisiana in the 1870s, 1880s, 1890s, after the Civil War. And they're speaking English, they're speaking Creole, they're speaking French, they're actually speaking, what would we say? They're speaking the language that the people in Louisiana at the time spoke, which was a mixture of English with some French thrown in there. And those stories became very popular. She was able to publish them in some of the big magazines at the time, Vogue, by, for example. I think she had 20 stories in Vogue, 20 stories in Vogue, the same magazine that's been around today. At the time, Vogue published fiction as well as recipes and fashion and what it does today. Also, she had stories in The Atlantic and in Youth's Companion. She wrote about 100 of those stories. So the first novel didn't do anything, but toward the late 1890s, apparently her publisher suggested she try a novel. So she wrote this novel, The Awakening, which really was not well received. It was sort of trashed by the critics. They didn't like it. They thought it was unethical. They thought it was, it touched on too many sensitive subjects, and they didn't like that. So it got very bad reviews. She published a few more stories and then died in 1904. You remember that the St. Louis World's Fair took place in 1904. She would go there all summer. She had a summer pass. And apparently, she had a brain aneurysm as a result of having been at the fair on a very, very hot July day. And she never really recovered from that. And then, as I said, her fiction just sort of disappeared from view, partly, I suppose, because of those bad reviews. Partly, I don't know. Some of her short stories continued to appear in anthologies throughout the early part of the 20th century. A few of her stories appeared, but her novel was pretty much forgotten, and critics didn't pay much attention to it. You have to remember that American literature as an academic profession is a relatively new thing. There aren't the same number of people specializing in American literature in 1920 or 1930 as there are today. So, for some reason, good or bad, when her complete works appeared in 1969, everything took off like an explosion. People everywhere started writing PhDs like me, and people started doing translations. There were new paperbacks. People started paying much more attention to her. And today, I think it's accurate to say she's one of the most widely read classic American authors. I'm careful on how I'm saying this. She's, I think, among a half dozen most widely taught and most widely read American classic authors. Heather, am I getting those words right? I
Oh
think
no,
that's
you're right, and even the Columbia University syllabus project is a testament to that. I mean, she appears in over, I think it's over a million syllabi, correct?
Seven. There's a group at Columbia that publishes a thing called the Open Syllabus Project,
Yeah,
and
that's what it is.
they've collected something like 7 or 8 million syllabi from all over the world. from 140 countries.
I'm so sorry.
And you can search it. You can, yeah, we go on the website. We have a list there. You can go in there and search. You can tell what field you want, what countries you want, what do you want to know about. If you go through that and you look at that, Kate Chopin's short story, The Story of an Hour, is the second most widely taught short story, period. Not classic short story, just short story, period. And her novel, The Awakening, I think is rated number 5. And if you take the first 50, that goes 50 per page. If you look at the first page of that, she's the only American who has two works on that first 50 pages, along with two Brits, Shakespeare and Jonathan Swift. That's not bad for a writer, is it? That's not bad.
You know, I think also you're raising a good point about American literature just as an area of study. But I think, and that's partly why she's, in addition to some of the bad reviews she got, but I kind of laugh because in The Awakening, we have these issues that come up that are, you know, a little transgressive, but At Fault really packs it in. Her first novel, it has like divorce and alcoholism and murder. Like she just threw in everything in there. And I guess because that's probably why it really disappeared. And it's, I don't find it to be the most easily accessible novel. I've read it a few times and like it's not The Awakening. Something happens in her craft in those 10 years between those two books, where they look like really different books. But also as a woman writer in the United States, I think that's also wasn't helping the longevity or the renown of her works. And you know, think about who she's writing with or who comes just after her. She's eclipsed by Edith Wharton, Willa Cather. I mean, Willa Cather had a couple things to say about her work too. but she's also at the now, she's at this edge where she's first identified more of a local color writer. So that's dismissed as more of a female genre anyway, even though there are elements and other scholars think there are elements of, you know, proto-modernism in there. She definitely feels the signs of her times. But then modernism happens and sort of like piles on to all of those late 19th century writers. So naturalism comes for, you know, like she's sort of lost in the mix. So it kind of, there's a lot of different forces. And she comes out, I guess, when we need her, you know, when literature becomes a little more, the study of literature becomes a little more democratized so that we can hear voices of writers who were maybe earlier marginalized or not taken as seriously.
No, I think that's right. Heather doesn't maybe remember this, Heather. Kate Chopin's work started coming back because of a guy named Cyril Arnavon in France who translated The Awakening into French in 1952. And he says exactly what Heather just said. If this book had been written by a woman, it would have been accepted. And he said, if it had been written in French, she would be a major French writer at this point. So it is partly context. It is true that women's writers did not have the same clout in 1940, 50 that they do today. I mean, of course, we had Louisa May Alcott and we had the magnificent Emily Dickinson. We can't forget about this.
Oh, yeah.
And Harriet Beecher Stowe, but and Alcott, especially for me, is she's a major writer, and so is of course Emily Dickinson. So I guess Nate, that's a quick thing, Heather. I don't know what did I miss that you should add in there about Kate Chopin's life or career.
It's interesting to me, you know, like you mentioned Alcott and Dickinson, and you know, of course there's others, but as far as the canon goes at that time, it's like as if only two women were writing, right? And you know, it's like, you know, who decides the what gets to be in the American literary canon at that time? It was old white men, you know, and it's interesting that like the term sensitive subjects, right, that The Awakening brings up and that Chopin brings up in a lot of her writing, was really just truths, right? And that's one thing I've really liked about reading critiques of Chopin's work is the, you know, how truth, it, you know, it's malleable, right? It changes. Your truth can change and that's okay. And yeah, she was writing and speaking to truths and giving words to truths that were inside women at that time and their minds and hearts that weren't being spoken so much, really, yeah. right? Like, do you yeah. think it was that part of the backlash of the awakening that it was?
Sure.
Yeah.
The way I would say it is, Heather, Kate Chopin at one point uses, in describing truth, the way she says it is, this is her language, not mine. She said, "What's truth is kaleidoscopic."
I knew you were going to say that.
I love that word because it's a perfect totally. Example of how.
If you didn't say it, I was going to. Yeah.
Of how you describe what's truthful. I mean, exactly. Everybody who looks in that kaleidoscope sees the same thing. It's the same pieces of glass, you know. And but there are the mirrors, and as you turn it, that pattern changes. Okay. So it not only changes for each person who picks up the kaleidoscope. The truth is different, but it changes for you as you turn it. And I think somehow the way she says it is, Kate, truth rests upon a shifting basis and is apt to be kaleidoscopic. I don't think there's a better explanation of how to think about truth.
I agree. I think that's and that really, I think, sums her up too, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's her, the way she articulates truth is both stable and shifting at the same time. Yeah. It's cool.
That's right. I think that's
yeah,
right.
And it's honest, you know, that's what yeah. I appreciate. It's that, you know, open and
there so are that's an interesting thing too. In a lot of her stories, and certainly in The Awakening, the narrative voice too, I mean, Bernie, what do you think? Like, it doesn't have any doesn't have a judgment of of a narrator, right? It just, I think that's why, like, some of us are sensitive to what we perceive to be, this must be the truth, right? Because the narrators don't bear judgment upon the subject.
That's right.
You know, and it makes a choice. She moves out of her husband's house, and it's just, it is what it is, to use that phrase, you know? Yeah. She just, this is what's happening, and we don't have a narrator that, there are moments that Edna is aware of disapprovals. It's not like it's not that she's unaware of it, but the narrator doesn't guide us in how we should be moral or thinking about the main character, which is why I think we can come back to it. Many of us come back to her stories and we find new things in them. You know, from certainly when I was 18, I read The Awakening and I completely understood Edna's longing for Robert, right? Because, like, I knew all about wanting a boyfriend. I was desperate to have a boyfriend. I didn't know how to get one, you know? but now, you know, 30 years later, in a different moment in my life, that I understand her desire to have a life of her own or something of her own that's not defined by family responsibilities, you know, that makes more sense to me, you know? So I think that the narrator's lack of judgment about any of that, and sometimes humor too, the way she, you know, the certain satire she includes, makes us able to find our way into the stories in different places in our lives and,
sure.
and make our own claims to truth and how we perceive it.
Sure. She's descriptive, like Heather says, she describes. She doesn't judge and she doesn't comment even. It's one of the things that the critics, I think, were upset about with The Awakening. It's not so much even what this character, Edna, does in the book. It's that Kate Chopin doesn't complain about it. She doesn't punish her. She does. She describes what happens. And I'll stop there and say
no. Well, one of my favorite parts is that closer to the last quarter of the novel, is when Edna sort of kind of like throws her hands up in her mind, you know, in her mind, and she's sort of frustrated with like the limitations of, you know, having a lover. Today it's this one, today it's that, next day, like she's just sort of like, whatever, you know, but the narrator never says like, oh heavens, you know, how could she think she's a still married woman? And Edna is sort of like, well, today it's all set, you know, she's, you know, what difference does it make? It's not going to center her. It's not the thing that she's really desiring. She comes to understand in a very short period of time, which I thought was, and I still think is kind of shocking. I always think I read it wrong after all these times. Like, really? Even the sex part with Alcee, I'm like, really? Is that what that means? Like, because I'm like, no, it can't mean that. But it's so empty of judgment and innuendo. Like, we just, it is what it is. Well, it is a little innuendo. I wouldn't say she's not direct about that part, but
yeah, no, I think that's right.
Yeah, that's a great point. And that kind of leads me into another question of her literary techniques she uses. So that, you know, the narrator being a you know, objective observer of what's happening and not just kind of relaying facts. There's no, like you said, no judgment. And yeah, so I'm just curious if there are any in your studies, any sort of literary techniques that she utilized a lot that are kind of a signature element of her work. You mentioned modernism earlier as well. You know, she seems to be a precursor to that. Like you said, she's kind of in that in between of literary movements. So yeah, I'm just curious if you have any thoughts more on that. Heather, do you have any ideas?
I think there's a lot of answers to that. Certainly she favors like a third person narrator. There are a couple short stories where there's a first person, which is always surprising to me in a way. I guess I sort of like fall into a certain assumption. Isn't that funny? Some people have written about like her pre-closure points in certain stories. Like she has short stories that have moments where the stories can actually be organized into units. And that would be considered possibly, you know, a precursor to the modernist period too. Some of her stories end in, without giving away anything, certain ambiguities that also lend themselves to a technique maybe that we find more in the early 20th century. But really, you know, the thing, if anyone were to ask me that question on a podcast in the Midwest, what I would really want to make sure we understood is that she writes, in my opinion, and I read this for other people, like music. She was very heavily influenced by music. So so if you pull out, and I think this is more characteristic of The Awakening than a lot of her work, really, but she has a rhythmic quality to her prose, and it's imbued with metaphors that are, they're like loaded, you know, you're pulled into like a kaleidoscopic metaphor, you know, that it triggers all kinds of responses, good ones, you know, like she brings you into the prose. Her sentences are not especially long, but there's definitely an organization to them at times. Bernie, what do you think?
Well, yeah. And in terms of the language, I often think of her as somewhere stuck between two of her contemporaries, Mark Twain on one side and Henry James on the other side. Mark Twain, you remember, people who have studied American literature understand this. Mark Twain moved the sound, the language of the story away from the coasts. He used inland speech, used rural speech. And so does Kate Chopin. Most of her characters are rural characters. I mean, there is The Awakening with some sophisticated Creoles, but most of them are, she captures the speech of those characters. Her language is full of these expressions. I had them written down somewhere. They don't see them anywhere, but she's constantly saying things like tiens, or voila, or allez-vous-en, or when am I going to see you next? Jeudi, next Thursday. What are we going to have for lunch? Courbouillon. And on like that. It's full of little French expressions, and it's full of mixtures of sounds. So on the one hand, she's like Mark Twain in her style, in that she's capturing inland speech rather than coastal speech, like Henry James captures. On the other hand, she's like Henry James, because I love Henry James, by the way. I think he created a language for sensitivity, for understanding, for looking. And language, Kate Chopin has that. It's a language of, I don't want to over-dramatize this, but it's a language of compassion. It's a language of, as Hesiod said, of acceptance. She likes these characters. She likes people.
Yeah.
She's a loving woman. And that comes across in that fiction, I think. It's hard to not see that in her. It's hard to miss the French, because it's everywhere. I suppose if you read only The Story of an Hour, you might not see that. But in anything else, or almost anything else she wrote, you would see the French, and you would feel this essential acceptance of people being what they are and who they are where they are and how they're responding to their environment. So I think in that sense, people will find in Kate Chopin's style, her language, these elements that Hester mentioned. It's hard to miss her once you start reading her things. You know you're reading her because she doesn't sound like other American writers.
Yeah.
Could I read two paragraphs? Okay. So
yes, please, I love that.
I'm going to spare you all my French accent. Just read in English because Bernie is much more adept at that than I am. But just to give an example, I was looking. So this is a moment in the awakening. It's earlier. And Edna, our main character, has learned to swim, something that she's been wanting to do. Everybody else can swim. And just imagine, you know, turn of the century, late 19th century, what she's probably wearing, probably is why she can't swim. But she learns how to swim. And our narrator says, but that night she was like the little tottering, stumbling, clutching child who of a sudden realizes its powers and walks for the first time alone, boldly and with overconfidence. She could have shouted for joy. She did shout for joy. As with a sweeping stroke or two, she lifted her body to the surface of the water. A feeling of exultation overtook her, as if some power of significant import had been given her soul. She grew daring and reckless, overestimating her strength. She wanted to swim far out, where no woman had swum before.
Yeah.
First day swimming.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I love that. Yeah.
Star Trek.
That's right. That's
yeah, that's true.
Japan's impact is far and wide.
That's right, yeah. Across the universe. Thank you for reading that, Heather. That was a great passage. And it's great, too, because it, you know, she herself was a woman who swam where no one had swum before in her writing, right? Like, yeah, that's a great way to encapsulate that.
Yeah.
It's interesting too that you mentioned Henry James, Bernie, because as I was reading her, that's who I was thinking of as well. It was like, and you know, timeline wise, they're around the same era as well. But I'm curious if either of you know of any other, what was Kate Chopin reading? As she was. Because I know, from what I understand, she was very interested in music and the arts and reading herself as well. So I'm curious if you know of any literary influences on her.
Well, because she's bilingual, she's reading throughout her childhood and her adolescence in both French and English. Actually, she's also reading in German. I don't think she's spoke German well, although our Heidi, a woman in Germany who's part of our group, she probably would not agree with that, although I'll have to ask her. But she read in French as well as in English, and she read an awful lot. She knew, for example, the Norwegian, Ulrik Ibsen's A Doll's House. She knew Anna Karenina, it seems like. She must have read those in translation. She definitely knew Gustave Flaubert's Madame Bovary. She knew Emile Zola's Nana. She knew French women writers like Germaine de Staël and Georges Sand. That's an interesting woman. Her name sounds like a male name, but it's Georges. And Georges Sand wrote a book called Lélia, and Kate Chopin called. She didn't name her daughter after this, but she called her daughter Lélia, so that there's a connection with that. But the most important influence on Kate Chopin's life, from everything I can tell, and that I think most critics who have studied her will conclude the same thing, was a guy named Guy de Maupassant. Maupassant was a French writer of short stories. And if I could read a passage here, this is not from her fiction, but from her reviews. She writes at one point about how she was trying to learn to write fiction, and she was struggling with it. She says she couldn't quite figure out how to express herself properly the way she wanted to. And she says, this is all her language, no, not mine. It was at this period of my emerging from the vast solitude in which I had been making my own acquaintance that I stumbled upon Maupassant. I read his stories and marveled at them. Here was life, not fiction, for where were the plots, the old-fashioned mechanisms and stage trapping that in a vague, unthinking way I had fancied were essential to the art of story-making? Here was a man who had escaped from tradition and authority, who had entered into himself and looked out upon life through his own being and with his own eyes, and who, in a direct and simple way, told us what he saw. When a man does this, he gives us the best he can. I think that's a very, very nice way of explaining how Kate Chopin came to do what she did. She loved what Maupassant was able to do with words. And of course, now she's reading him in French, and she's trying to find a way to take what he's doing in French and making it work in English, which is, you know, she was bilingual, bicultural, really, meaning she's functioning in both French-speaking and English-speaking cultures, and captures a lot of what's French. But that, I think that was probably her biggest influence. And Heather, you know, obviously she read other things.
Well, I think we should mention how she was really interested in the new sciences of the day. So she was interested in Darwin, Thomas Huxley, Herbert Spencer. She's just an interesting figure, and it coincides or dovetails just when she's letting go of her Catholic, maybe not her faith necessarily. I don't really know about that, but the practice of Catholicism. So it dovetails at that moment. She's reading more about the new sciences of the age as she's letting go of the practice, although that's really kind of when she gets married too. But certainly as she becomes a widow, she's like released definitely from her Catholic practice. And what a surprise, she starts writing around the same time too.
Yeah.
By the way, Heather did a whole book on Kate Chopin and Catholicism. You should read that. She has a lot of very interesting insights in that book.
Thank you. By the way, I think we should also mention our good friend and colleague Tom Bonner has a really interesting article on her Presbyterianism and Chopin.
Yes. And Emily Toth wrote one about
Unitarianism.
Unitarianism.
That's right. That's right.
So we have all these isms.
I mean, that's a whole, to me, it's so interesting the idea of not religion necessarily, but the possibility of, I don't know how even to say it, the unseen or meaning beneath regular life. I mean, I would be hesitant to assign her, you know, the usual discourse of faith and religion. I wouldn't want to venture into that. But Catholicism it appears over and over again in her work for sure. But Catholicism as a material religion, as a very earthly body, you know, type of religion, makes a lot of sense in a way for her work, because, you know, with Kate Chopin's The Awakening, we have a character who comes into knowing her body in a way she hasn't in the past, right? She learns how to swim. She ventures out of her marriage. She starts to paint. Like she moves into this physical space of being. And there are direct references to when she's a child and she's a Presbyterian growing up. And so she moves this from being in her head to of this world. And I think that when I think about Catholicism in her work, it raises some interesting questions, because some of her work too also points to, I think, a mystical element in the sense of the medieval female mystics. And certainly she knew some of them because of her time at parochial school. I don't know if I could make I don't do this anywhere else where I make a hard and fast argument about it. But it raises certain questions, you know. What did she know? How did she perceive the world? And I think that the title, The Awakening, for instance, lends itself to the possibility of more than what we see in front of us in this life. That's what I think.
Mm-hmm. and like Heather will tell you, it's Marian Catholicism. It's based heavily on Mary. So there is I grew up as a
Oh,
Roman Catholic.
yeah,
And
that's true. That's
I don't know how
true.
much I saw. I went to school with the nuns for 8 years. I can build a wonderful May altar. You ought to see some of the May altars they taught us how to build. So it's deeply based on a woman, powerful figure in what you're believing and what you're
Right.
seeing.
I mean, it's
Yes.
more than a couple of priests that sort
Oh,
of
yeah.
get her characters, bent out of shape a little bit, or she, they're set up sort of ironically, or in a vocation and a voice.
Yeah.
We have our young man becomes a priest eventually. I think he's a priest, right? He becomes a priest at the end, but it's
He's
the
a
sound of a
father.
woman's voice.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That'll always
Yeah.
bring him back.
That's right. That's
And
right.
then Edna in The Awakening, right? She goes to mass and she starts to feel woozy.
Right.
I mean, I think that Chopin takes this ironic, but she's this ironic position toward religion, and she understands what rote prayer can do and what doctrine can do, but she also sees the value in renewal, redemption, and her emphasis on nature in so many of her stories, the natural world. We have more than one character okay. Disclaimer, this is the ending for several stories, but several characters sort of walk off into marshes or swim out into water, and they, that's it. We don't know where they go exactly, but there is this sense of ascension for some of them. Or descension, as it were. So I think I think that is a perspective that you could bring, if you're inclined to it. You don't have to read her that way, though. I think that's I choose to at times. I see it.
Yeah. I think that again is another testament to the rereading of it and the quality of her work and how you can look at it with different lenses. And again, I'll bring back the kaleidoscope. It's depending on what filter you put through that glass, you're going to see it in a different way.
Sure.
And I think that is just very impressive of her. We were talking about The Awakening a little bit earlier, and the sort of ambiguity of the ending, which is also, I think, a great choice as an author to, not necessarily wrap it up in a little, all right, here's the ending, and then it's like the end of a movie where it's like, and then this person went on to be this, and this this person graduated with the honors or whatever.
Right.
But the reader decides what happens, and that's a beautiful thing because it rewards rereading and rewards being introduced to new readers who have never encountered the work again and again, which I also wanted to ask about. You both have been professors and have taught Chopin's work. When you do, how do you what do you say to your students about why they should read this work or why it's being included in the syllabus, or how do you get a young person to pick up this book from 1899?
I
It is a
have to say
challenge, isn't it?
something. What's that, Vernon?
I said that is a challenge, isn't it, these days?
I'm at a place in my career where I sometimes don't qualify it with more than saying, like, this is a story I really like, and I want you to know it before you leave college.
That's good enough.
It? I don't know. I mean, I don't know. There was a time where I would show, remember the movie Thelma and Louise? Did you ever see that movie?
Of
And I
course.
would show a clip of the ending to make sure, like, our students understood the ending of a certain novel by Kate Chopin and align it with, like, the ambiguity, like, just to emphasize, like, the characters are so loved and their struggle is so important that the narrators and the or the filmmakers just can't let you see them die. Like, I would try to do it that way. At some point, Thelma and Louise became sort of outdated. I do have to say, with The Awakening, I feel confident that just because, and Bernie knows this too, we have hundreds of thousands of people, I'm not exaggerating or bragging, that come to the website every year, about 400, over 400,000 a year. And many of them write to us from all over the world, and they'll say something like, "The story spoke to me." You know, they'll talk to us about how the story resonated. So I don't often feel like I have to fight hard for this story. And then with her short stories that I teach, because they are the ones that are most common, that's what I would, I mean, I teach it at community college, so I teach the ones that are, first level, second level, lit courses. They're accessible, but they're the ones that are most well known are, they have good irony. They have good twists in them. They have like the shocking, like, she died of heart her heart problems, like when she sees her husband alive and well, like those things still provoke students. They go like, "Oh my God, what?"
That's
Like,
exactly what I said out loud as I was reading them this past week. I was like, oh, dang.
I know. Or Desiree's Baby. That's another one. That's another story that my students, that is one of the few stories that dates before, is set before. It's not written, but it's set before the Civil War. That it just, it blows them away often. Those who are not like, wrought with cynicism and boredom with the modern world.
Yeah,
But
those short stories and the endings were, they reminded me of O. Henry, and that, that twist that was
That's
always
yeah.
at the end of his work as well.
I teach her sometimes with Edith Wharton, with like Roman Fever, for instance, that one. I had Barbara.
And I think those ending, those closing sentences also are tied to Maupassant. That's what de Maupassant did. He wrote those kinds of things.
Oh
Now,
yeah,
the
sure.
other thing with trying to work with students, I've taught this novel in three or four different countries. It's surprising. I never had to explain why we're reading something to my students in Poland. You just didn't ask that kind of a question. This was a long time ago when people. You didn't need to justify what you were doing. But boy, my students reacted badly to that. The Awakening is about a relatively wealthy woman. I mean, she has a servant to look after her children, who cooks the meal. She doesn't clean. She doesn't need to clean because the servant cleans, and she can be hanging out on the beach with these characters, learning to drink wine and to flirt. And I was in Poland in the 1980s, when the country was still under Soviet control and was under martial law. And there were shortages of virtually everything. I remember I learned to carry a bag with me because when you went out on the street, you saw a line of people standing up to buy something. So you just got in the line. You didn't know what they were standing up to buy. You bought whatever you could buy, and then you could trade it with somebody else for something they wanted. I bought a banjo one time. I don't know what to do with a banjo, but you can trade a banjo for somebody else. So I remember when my students there in Poland, and they were smart people, smart students. A couple of them actually are still teaching here in the United States at Notre Dame, I believe. At any rate, when my students read that story, they said, I asked them, well, what do you think? And I remember the one young woman standing up and saying, the trouble with Edna Pontellier is she never has to stand in line to buy bread. Well, they were not in, they didn't in, they weren't focused on the position of women or the position. What they were focusing on was economics, because that story is about relatively wealthy people having a relatively high quality life. I mean, it's a warm climate. Poland, it's cold in Poland. Even in June, it's cold in Poland. And they reacted in a very different way to that. So I think, as you say, it's tough to motivate people to read. I really don't care at the beginning, at least, what students find in what they read. I think it's important for them to read it, and what they do with it then is for their own. They'll change as they mature and as they find different experiences that influence what they see.
Yeah, that's a great point, because that story of your student Bernie reminds me of, well, the kaleidoscope quote comes from Chopin's review of one of Emile Zola's books, right? If I'm getting
That's
that
right.
correct.
Right.
And where in which Chopin didn't necessarily like the book, but understood that it was the truth for Zola, right? And so, and again, that's like, what whatever eye you put in front of the kaleidoscope, it's going to look different. And that is that, yeah. And that also brings me to you. I know we're getting close to the end here, but another question I like to ask, and as times have changed, like you've taught in Poland in the 80s and elsewhere since. So, but what do you think? How do you think Chopin would be engaging with our current world? And again, this is just pure conjecture. We don't, it's kind of have fun with it. We don't know, obviously, don't know for sure. But I'm just curious what you think.
Well, I don't know. I know I look my age, but I wasn't there, so I never met this woman, and I don't know what she would think. But if she were here today, I don't think she would be pushing for social change so much. That's not what she does. I don't think. She did not like Ibsen's A Doll's House because she said it takes as its theme social problems, which by their very nature are mutable, they change. And writing about social problems and social change and the difficulties that people have because of race or gender or economics or origin or ethnicity, or that wouldn't. That's not enough to ensure the survival of a writer who uses them. So I don't think that's what she would be doing. You know, it's funny you ask that, Nate. I was asked that question once before. I had done this weird, this was before the days of Zoom, this telecast with a group of women in Kuwait, in two different universities in Kuwait. They had been arranged somehow by the American embassy, and they're all wearing hijabs, and they're all sitting there in these two huge rooms, all women. In the back of each room were a group of men just standing, looking quietly on all this. And they asked a bunch of questions about Kate Chopin, and I answered them. And then the last question was from a woman who said, "If Kate, just what you asked, Nate, if Kate Chopin were here today, what would she tell us?" Well, you know, I wasn't prepared for that, and what I said, I'm not sure I said have said should have said. I guess I said I think she'd say to you, "Be yourself, be true to yourself." And the women all smiled, and the men looked like if they could strangle me, they would do that. But I've often wondered about that. I don't know whether that was a good thing to say or not say. The thing about Heather and I think agree on this. The thing that makes Kate Chopin complicated to read is that even though her fiction is based upon individual freedom and individual choice and the importance of the individual living the kind of life that they want. That's the heart of what she is. But she is also aware of the community. I think she understands that an individual lives in a community, but in a way, the community lives in the individual. The individual is everything that her culture and that her language and that her upbringing and even the food that she eats and the clothes that she wears, it's all there. So I think Kate Chopin is always, there's always a sense of balance in Kate Chopin. Heather will I think agree with this. You can see that in At Fault in her early novel. This woman is making some very bad decisions. She falls in love with a man and says to him, he's divorced because his wife was alcoholic. She persuades him to go back and remarry his alcoholic wife. I mean, this is not smart on her, and it produces very bad results. But she also understands that this woman, who has responsibilities for running a plantation and for being responsible for the lives of the people who work on that plantation, she's very well aware of her obligations to that community. And she I think Kate Chopin understands that yes, you need to be free to be who you are and to be what you can be, but you're living with another group of people so that your needs and your wants are important, but so are theirs. And my wife constantly quotes her father, who would say to him, yes, you're free to do whatever you want, but your freedom ends where my freedom begins. And I think Kate Chopin's aware of that too, that she's not a radical in that sense. She's grown up during the Civil War. Mm-hmm. And she's watched what happens when you have rapid, overpowering social change that destroys the kind of life you had before that war began. I don't see Kate Chopin as somebody who's pushing for another revolution. She's had one. She's seen what that's like. I don't think of her as a going out in the streets.
Like an activist.
But again, yeah. I wasn't there. I don't
She's
know.
No Heather, eloquent woman.
Heather, what about you? I don't know.
I would agree. I think she's just sort of interested in people and amused, yeah, and kind of amused by them, you know, just sort of took it in, right? To her world. I would agree with the focus on like a community perspective, but I think when it came down to it, she thought about people,
mm-hmm,
and she knew her world. I mean, she wasn't looking, I agree, she wasn't looking to protest things, and her husband was definitely involved with white supremacist circles in,
yes,
New Orleans. Like, we can't ignore that. That does not come up in her work. So I think that in her response to a world today, I don't think it would impact her observations more than just individual relationships and,
yeah,
you know, human desire and disappointment and hope. You know?
Right. Yeah. I agree too, because that's, and again, that's why it's so rewarding to go back to, because those things don't change. Human desires and hopes and disappointments and love and loss, those, mm-hmm, every, you know, every generation, every culture movement, every rebellion knows those things. And so I agree. I do think she would be good on, like, I don't know, Twitter or not, perhaps more like TikTok or Instagram, to kind of have the visual aspects too. Like, I think she would have a good
riding around on her horse, smoking a cigarette.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. What do you think? What would her social media channel of choice be, do you think?
Well, let me put it this way. She's a very complex writer, and every time you think you have a clear picture of something, you can find something else. Let me put it like this. I don't think AI, or artificial intelligence, I don't think AI is ever going to understand her fully, because she's too complicated for those algorithms to be able to say this is what she is. She's something more than whatever it is you think she is. She's one of the great ones, I think, as a way to sum it all up. She's up there. She belongs with the great ones, with Dickinson and with Alcott and with Henry James and Mark Twain. And
I think she too would take it all in. You know, you brought up Twitter and TikTok. I think you know, she was into the stereoscope. She knew about the kaleidoscope.
Yeah.
These type of, mm-hmm, like visual technologies were totally interesting, not just to her, but of that moment. And she was right there with them. So I think she'd just be fascinated, like. You know, the first time when I saw TikTok and I saw kids everywhere filming themselves dancing, I was like, that's incredible. They're all speaking to each other in this new way. I thought it was amazing. I thought it was totally amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think she'd like the technology. There's a moment in The Awakening where this man who Edna has apparently sort of fallen in love with, this Robert character, comes to visit her, and he sees in her room a picture, a photograph of another guy that she's sort of fooling around with. That's the latest technology at the moment. That's the moment in time when photography became available to everybody. Before that, you only had pictures of royalty or super rich people who could afford to have somebody paint a picture of them. Now you had cameras that anybody could take a picture. Suddenly you got to see what you looked like yourself and what other people looked like. You could see family members who died, because now you have photographs of them. So that she, I think she would have embraced the technology. I don't know what she should have done with TikTok, but
it's totally fascinating. That's like one of my favorite parts too. When Robert is returned to her in New Orleans at the, near the end, and when he says like, "I've been crazy. I thought I could just scoop you off and get married," and she's like, "I'm not one of Leonce's possessions to give." It's one of my favorite moments.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's later after the picture, but yeah.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for that. As we're getting close to the end here, was there anything that we didn't touch on that either of you wanted to talk about or let our listeners know about Chopin?
I was thinking about the question of her influence into contemporary works. And at first I was like, I don't know. Who reads contemporary fiction? And then I started thinking about the Crawdads story, Where the Crawdads Sing. And then I just read Go as a River. And then I would even think like Circe, you know, the these newer novels. I always think I don't read contemporary work. And then I'm like, what's going on? I got to read them. And then I thought anything where we have a woman who stands aside and chooses her own way, you know, and makes her own way. And then this transformation, I'm like, that's really Chopin. That's really Chopin's gift to us, is a singular female protagonist who decides for herself. She's not the only one. I mean, you know, we have Antigone. It's not like she's the first one, but in American work too, I think we see this development, like a sustained development into an autonomy she decides for herself in a context that is sometimes not as flexible, you know, with Edna, it doesn't necessarily work. And some of those other stories, it doesn't necessarily work. Society is too rigid, or it's not the time and place. But that's what I was thinking about, because I thought, I wonder. And then I started thinking more of the stories that have come out in the last couple of years. Those are the ones that immediately come to mind.
Yeah, and there's others too. Some of you know Suman Kidd, who wrote The Secret Life of Bees. She was asked by a New York Times book review editor a few years ago. She asked, which novels have had the most impact on you as a writer? And she said, Kate Chopin's The Awakening, which I first read in college. And she describes how that had such a deep and lasting impression on her. And Barbara Kingsolver, who you know, she won a Pulitzer Prize for her
fiction. Oh, I didn't think of her, right.
Yeah, she did an interview with The Guardian in the UK a few years ago. And they asked her about who influenced her. And she said, as a member of the post-war generation, I arrived belatedly to both The Feminine Mystique and The Awakening. I read them in the same year, 1973. And the two books are intrinsically linked in my mind, because in tandem, they made me want to weep and rend my clothing. They gave me words to the increasingly suffocating atmosphere of a life I had entered, wherein it came to pass that boys would be boys and girls were charged with keeping them under control. I think that's a great line. And then there's this wonderful book by a guy named Robert Stone, who you maybe don't know. He wrote a book called Children of Light, which is a book about a film company making a movie of The Awakening. And in that movie, the woman who plays Edna Pontellier has a lot of the same kind of issues going on in her life as Edna Pontellier does. And Heather, you maybe remember this on the website. We have a little picture of a graphic novel, a graphic fiction by a woman named Gabrielle Bell, called Cecil and Jordan in New York. And one of the collection of short stories, one of them is based on Kate Chopin's The Story of a Novel. There's just so much. This is all on the website. There's two stage adaptations of The Awakening in the last few years, one in San Francisco, one in Tucson, Arizona. There are six films, 1, 2, 3 in 2017, one in 2016. There's two older films, which people might remember. There is a film called Grand Isle, which is the story of The Awakening with Kelly McGillis playing Edna Pontellier.
Which I'll never watch, because I never want to ruin the book.
Well, it's not easy to watch, because it's not available in a...
You know what's good is, remember Ripe Figs? Barbara Mules. Oh, such a great film. It's a little short film. It's on our website, but it's so good. It's so delicate and perfect. Like the nuances of character are so gentle and searing too at the same time.
There's some very strange things. There's a Christmas opera based on one of Kate Chopin's short stories called The Story of an Hour. This is all on the website. And then there is this goofy thing, and I think this is interesting. It's a website by a company called The Knowledgement. This is the name of it, The Knowledgement and Mind Expansiveness Company. And it has a passage called John and Kate Kill the Loch Ness Monster. And it goes like this: in a heroic piece of history that shall not soon be forgotten, the former second president of the United States, John Adams, and his wife, Kate Chopin, author of The Awakening, killed the legendary Loch Ness Monster in Scotland around 11 o'clock last night. And he explains how they are married and they're on their honeymoon and they go out in the water and the monster comes up. And fortunately, he says, Kate had her lucky harpoon gun with her, a memento
Like,
from the
wow,
Second
cool.
World War and an object she never leaves home without, and she kills the Loch Ness Monster. Now, I know that's goofy and funny and hilarious, but what's interesting about it for me is that it only is funny if you know who John Adams and Kate Chopin is. And the fact that that website can assume that its readers going to know who these two people are is what makes it funny. It's kind of like, if you ever want to know,
jokes.
there's this old story. If you want to know whether you've made it, if you want to know how famous you are, you need to know, do you show up in the New York Times crossword puzzle? If you, and it's something like that, it just is a sign of how well known Kate Chopin has become today that you can write that kind of a thing and people will laugh at it because they know who she
That's great.
is. It's a silly, silly story, but it always has hit me as a as
That's
an
very
interest in
funny.
an insight into something.
She made it. She made
She
it.
made it. Yeah, she's made it, I think. That's right.
Thank you for this, Bernie and Heather. And tell our listeners a little bit about you'll be in Chicago in Memorial Day weekend, right?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. For the
Yeah, what
occasion.
tell us a little bit about that panel.
Well,
Okay.
the Kate Chopin International Society always sponsors a panel or two and a business meeting at the American Literature Association convention. So this May, you're correct, over Memorial Day weekend, the conference is at the Palmer House, I think it is, the Hilton Palmer House in Chicago. And it's there are societies for all the study of so many different authors, like Fitzgerald's and Toni Morrison, like you can name it, American literature authors. There's a society for them, Emily Dickinson, Willa Cather. And so they were all affiliated with the American Literature Association. We'll be there. We have a rich panel. That information I don't have, but we can give you the link to it for sure, representing four different perspectives on her work this year. And at the MLA, we're hoping next January, the 19th Century American Forum is sponsoring a panel. I hope it gets approved, but it's a guaranteed panel. But I think the topic needs approval on New Orleans and Chopin, or Chopin's Louisiana. Maybe that's what it is. So a couple people will be there too. We're celebrating our 20th anniversary this year. So please go to our website. We have some good memories and comments from our board members there. But we're really lucky. We know that Bernie knows this, that a lot of society don't last beyond the 5th year mark, and we just keep going. As I said, I'm not bragging, and it's largely due to Bernie's hard work. We have between 400 and 450,000 visitors a year. I think that's cool. I love it when we get high school students. I love it when we get random people who have questions. And just to see that people are thinking about things that she raises, questions and issues she raises, or they just want to know, they're making connections in their lives. It's amazing. I mean, I'm sure you see this too in your own work, Nate. There's people all around the world have questions about fiction, and to be able to be in conversation with people I wouldn't necessarily meet in the course of my life has been one of the most amazing parts of this.
Yeah, I agree. It's what's so astonishing. When I began this half a century ago, virtually nobody knew Kate Chopin. And today, she shows up in Killing the Loch Ness Monster. You know, it's a pretty impressive,
Oh,
pretty.
and we're grateful to have some of her descendants in our society too.
Yes.
Oh, great. Yeah.
And there's three of them. You can find their pictures on there. And one of them has a comment on our 20th year. It's very
Great.
interesting.
Yeah. There's links in the episode description for you to check out all of their work. And you can also just Google Kate Chopin International Society, and it's a great resource if you're researching in school or just curious. You can read a lot of her work right there on the site, or there's links to other places as well. So I definitely recommend checking it out. And Heather and Bernie, once again, thank you for joining me today. I really enjoyed talking with you and learning more from you. And I'll see you in Chicago in a couple months.
Awesome. Thank you
Thank
so
you. Thank
much.
you, Ned. Thank you, Heather. Great
It's
to
much
see you
fun.
both.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Nation of Writers podcast, part of the American Writers Museum podcast network. If you'd like to learn more about American writers and their impact on our history, our culture, and our daily lives, find us online or come see us in person. The American Writers Museum is open Thursdays through Mondays from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., closed on Tuesdays and Wednesdays. Once again, thank you for listening, and to all you writers out there, thank you for writing.